It appears everybody is on screen. Good morning. I'm going to call to order the calendar for today, July 15, 2020. I can't believe it's July 15 already. The panel today is comprised of Francis Connolly, Tracy Smith, and myself, Renee Werke, as presiding judge. We have Matthew Huff as our marshal. If anyone can't hear, our host did alert at least the judges to the fact that we're a little raggy as far as our connection today. If there's at any time you can't hear or you can't see the timer, please say something or otherwise just wiggle your hand and I'll stop the proceedings to see what we need to do. With that said, I'm going to call the first case for oral presentation. That would be file A20-0077 Jane Doe Appellant versus Kelly Kirby and Winona State University. Counsel, when you're ready to begin your argument, you'll have the same rules of appellate procedure. Introduce yourself and indicate what party you're speaking on behalf of. 15 minutes each with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal to appellate counsel is our timing calendar. So, Mr. Kluke, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. My name is Brian Kluke, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Jane Doe. If anyone can't hear me, please let me know. I received a notice that my microphone possibly has some feedback, so please forgive me if that's the case. May it please the court. Winona State's counselor sexually abused Ms. Doe on Winona State's campus, and Winona State employees were aware of it. Ms. Doe's lawsuit seeks to hold Winona State responsible for the actions of its employee.
Isn't that pretty much the thrust of the entire argument that we have? You're alleging that Jane Doe was assaulted on campus, on Winona State, and we get down to what is actually meant by the term assaulted. You acknowledge that an actual act of criminal sexual conduct did not occur on any campus property. Isn't that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And I would also just correction. There is no allegation of an assault. Our allegation is of grooming that occurred on Winona State's campus. And so it's in the district court's order that Ms. Doe alleges a sexual assault. That is not pleaded in her complaint. What Ms. Doe alleges is abuse. And the complaint describes a very typical case of abuse.
We don't have a definition of grooming. I know in your brief, I call it a definition of grooming. You've indicated giving gifts or messaging as grooming. What authority do you have that would be the definition that would be appropriate for this situation?
Your Honor, in fact, we are emphatic that grooming is much more than giving gifts or having conversations. That is actually the argument that Winona State makes. Their argument is that when we allege grooming in the complaint, they've tried to box us in by saying that our complaint has a definition of grooming in it, which is contained in paragraph 17, and that paragraph only includes giving gifts or having conversations. So if Your Honor has the Second Amended complaint handy, I would refer you to paragraph 9, where it simply says that grooming occurred at Winona State in their counseling office. That's paragraph 7, 8, and 9. Now, it's Winona State's argument that paragraph 17, which comes in later, essentially is a limiting factor on that, that because we've said in paragraph 17 that, well, part of that is giving gifts and having conversations or inappropriate conversations, that's all we mean. That's a definition that we put in our complaint.
How does that definition then fall within the range of actionable conduct for damages?
Your Honor, I want to stress that is not a definition. What we are saying is that we simply allege grooming in the complaint. And what we argue is that grooming is a term of art used or commonly used in sexual abuse cases. That term has been used in cases issued by this court to describe sexual predators, sexual abuse. And our argument is that grooming includes a wide range of conduct that can include,
Normally when I think of grooming, I think of, or it seems to come up in the context of children. So are any of the cases that you just referred to where we've discussed grooming involve adults?
Yes, I believe they are, Your Honor. So one of the cases we cite in our brief is Civil Commitment of Reed. That's a 2012 case, and Judge Wark, you were actually the author of that case, and Judge Conley, you were on the panel. And in that case, it was a sexual predator who, there were many allegations against him. I believe some of them did involve children, but there were other allegations where when he was committed as a resident, he was committing, you know, quote, highly sophisticated grooming techniques that he would use against the other residents in that sexual, some type of remediation area. But the broader point is that we allege grooming. Other cases of this court describe that grooming is, for example, we cite in our brief State versus Leong. That's a case where a psychiatrist was, quote, grooming his patients, and he did so by initiating conversations one, but also sitting next to them, touching them in unconsented to ways. He would touch
counsel,
the
counsel. This is Judge Smith. May I interrupt a moment? I want to put this into context of the claims, the counts in the complaint to understand, because there's disagreement among the parties, it seems to me, at what counts are at issue. Everyone agrees that the Med-Mal, I think, is not at issue, claim one. Claim four is negligence per se, which is criminal assault, which I assume an element of that would be actual crime of assault. And then I'm confused, but tell me if I'm wrong. I think you still argue that's at issue. Then we have claims two and three. Negligence is three, and I think Winona State says that's really a Med-Mal claim. And then claim two is sexual abuse. I feel like you're arguing, your argument goes to claim two, although it seems to be, in your brief, maybe broader. I wonder, what are the elements of your claim to sexual abuse, such that we could then determine whether it took place within the time and location requirements? What are the elements of that claim, sexual abuse?
Yes, Your Honor. The elements of sexual abuse are the tort of battery. The Supreme Court has issued cases saying that a claim of sexual abuse is based in the torts of battery or of negligence. And so the elements of battery being an unconsented to offensive contact. So if you were...
And have you alleged that in your complaint?
Well, not specifically. We allege sexual abuse, and that is what that claim is based on from an elements
perspective. So what is the unconsented to touching that took place within the time and location requirements on campus?
That is alleged in paragraph 9 of the complaint, where we say that grooming conduct occurred on Winona State's campus.
And what is the unconsented to conduct that's comprised, that's alleged as grooming? The unconsented to contact or touching.
What we argue is that grooming can certainly include unconsented to sexual touching, and that under Minnesota's notice pleading standards, that is sufficient for us to be able to survive a motion to dismiss. You know, our obligation under Rule 8 is to provide a short and plain statement of the claim, showing that we're entitled to relief. And what grooming is simply a common term of art used in sexual abuse cases that can include a wide range of conduct, from conversations, inappropriate gifts, touching. All of those types of things are part of the term of art encompassed within the term grooming. And so there's been the urge in this case, it was certainly the case at the district court below, that they want to jump to conclusions about what grooming does and doesn't include. The district court, for example, jumped to the conclusion that the only time in our complaint where we were alleging sexual abuse is when we used the word sexual contact. And that is simply not the case. We've gone to great pains in our briefing to distinguish between sexual contact, which is a defined term in Minnesota criminal law, and sexual abuse, which is simply,
what you said in answer to my question is that grooming can include unconsented to sexual touching. And because it can include that unconsented to sexual touching, that could be a battery, which could then be the basis of sexual abuse. So it right. seems to me in your answers this morning, you are agreeing that an element to that claim, ultimately, I understand it's sort of tiered, is sexual touching. Is that right? Unconsented to sexual touching.
It's unconsented to sexual touching or unconsented to contact of a sexual nature, which is not the same thing as grooming. But yes, Your Honor is correct.
Not the same thing as sexual contact, you mean? You think it is grooming?
Correct. Because...
Okay, I'd rather... The grooming seems to me... I mean, I understand the argument about how it plays in, but I'm trying to figure out relative to the claims. It does seem to me that there has to be sexual touching then ultimately proved, and what you're saying is it could be inferred from the word grooming. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. Again, and the reason for that is because grooming is a common term of art used in sexual abuse cases. This court has issued cases describing exactly that, using the term grooming. And another great example is the Minnesota Supreme Court case of Marston versus Minneapolis Clinic of Psychiatry and Neurology. And we cite many examples in our brief of unconsented to sexual touching that was the basis for the claims in that case. And those cases went to trial and what eventually went to the Supreme Court. And just to give you some examples. So here are some examples from Marston and other cases. This is from State versus Leong, which again, Judge Warkey was the author. Judge Connolly was on the panel. So here are some examples of things which can be sexual abuse, which are not sexual contact. Again, pulled directly from case law. A therapist unbuttoning the blouse of a patient, touching the patient's thighs.
But you've acknowledged, Mr. Kluk, you've acknowledged none of that is present here. And we go back again to this undefined grooming. Even if we would draw inferences in your client's favor, I don't know that you have an actionable claim for relief without alleging any touching. The cases you're alluding to all had an element of touch. So how can we read grooming into the touching behavior?
Because, Your Honor, those cases had an element of touch because they had the chance to do discovery and they had the chance to find out what actually occurred. Here we have not had that opportunity. We are simply at the motion to...
How does your client not know what's occurred, such as it could be put in a complaint as a factual basis for a claim?
Well, and certainly my client does know what has or has not occurred, has not been deposed yet. But our point is for purposes of the sufficiency of our claim, a simple Rule 12 standard under our notice pleading standards, where all we have to plead is a claim sufficient to let them know what is being pleaded and that there is enough potentially there that survives to satisfy the claim. And so when we allege grooming, it's a broad allegation that includes many types of conduct. It doesn't have the, you know, it doesn't get into specifics, but at the motion to dismiss stage, we are not required to prove those specifics or lay out every potential thing in the complaint. For surviving a motion to dismiss, it's sufficient that we say, this is what our claim is, this is what it constitutes, and then we move on to discovery. So it could be, you know, we can find out in discovery what it does and doesn't occur, doesn't consist of. But the point is that all of these cases knew exactly what happened because they had the chance to have discovery. And that's what my client deserves here. Especially when you consider what the district court did in this case, is he simply decided that in the complaint, the only thing that we meant by sexual abuse was sexual contact. And that itself is error.
Can you respond to what about claims 3 and 4? How can a negligence per se claim survive this motion if it requires a criminal sexual assault and that's there's not one to have alleged to have occurred on the campus during a time?
Well, I do want to clarify that what we are seeking specifically is the reversal of count 7, which was our claim of vicarious liability against Winona State University. So what the district court...
I appreciate that, but it's... Yes, but they all... It's vicarious for these various claims, right? Is what
yes,
you argue in your brief. We have to vicarious for the particular claims that are direct.
Yes, and so just clarifying, the district court and we all focus primarily on count 2, and there really isn't much discussion of claims 3 and 4, but if the claim of vicarious liability is restored, it would, you know, make those counts live again, although, you know, you could have further proceedings based on those counts. So again, the focus here is that The district court dismissed count 7, which effectively removed Winona State from the case because the district court decided there could be no vicarious liability for any of those claims. But there wasn't any
close enough. By looking at whether those claims were satisfactorily pleaded. And so I'm hearing you argue, as we look at the underlying claims, that claim 2 should really be the focus.
Yes.
The viability of that claim for purposes of vicarious liability.
Right. And the reason Judge Opat dismissed count 7 is because he was able to conclude on a reading of the complaint alone that no liability-creating conduct occurred on Winona State's campus. And what we are arguing is that, yes, it did. We definitely plead that. And while we don't get into specifics, that is what discovery is for. And my client deserves to have is a chance to expound in discovery upon what did or did not happen. And if there's a motion for summary judgment, there's a motion for summary judgment. But at the motion to dismiss stage, we have satisfied that standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klug. We'll turn to respondent counsel. Wait one moment for our timing to get set up. There we go.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chad Hintz. I represent the respondent, Winona State University, in this appeal. The confusion about how to analyze the vicarious responsibility of Winona State University rests on this concept that sexual abuse is grooming, and that's sufficient. Grooming is sexual abuse such that because it happened at the university can be vicariously responsible, at least at the pleading stage. Supreme Court has said in Lichtig v. Kohler, it's 782 Northwest 2nd 810. It's a 2010 Minnesota Supreme Court decision. It's cited at page 16 of their brief. And in that case, the Supreme Court received a certified question, three questions from the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. The first question was, does Minnesota recognize a separate common law cause of action for, quote, sexual abuse? And the court answered the question in the negative. And in doing so, it said, we don't have this separate tort for, quote, sexual abuse. What is actionable and what is recognized in Minnesota is existing common law tort claims. And they can be based upon conduct that's sexual abuse, but the sexual abuse itself isn't. And that usually it falls into two different groups, a negligence group, and I'll get to that in a second, and then this intentional tort group. And when you're talking about sexual assault, that's a battery. And the court said, when you plead battery, you have to allege facts that show intent and contact. And so when you look at the allegations in the complaint and this grooming stuff that falls short of the actual sexual contact, all of this inappropriate conversation, gift given.
Do you mean, when you say contact, you mean physical contact?
Actual physical touching, that's correct. That's required for a tort of battery, sexual battery. And so that's really count 2. Even though entitled sexual abuse, that's not a claim because it's not recognized. What is recognized as sexual battery is required to touch it.
So then Mr. Hatch, your voice fades quite a bit. Can you try and get closer to your microphone, please? I'm having difficulty hearing.
Okay. When you look at the allegations in the complaint in that context, and don't look at them as globally sexual abuse, but look at them for what they are, the conversations, the gift giving, the using the email to communicate, all of those allegations fail to state a cause of action for intentional sexual battery because they miss the element of physical contact that's required.
So, counsel, I wanted to understand how this fits in the rule about scope of, the key question here within the scope of the employment, which is, so what if during, let's assume that it had been pled and that while the plaintiff was a patient at Winona State, the counselor, you know, gave gifts, non-sexual touching, told the person they wanted to have a sexual relationship, was very explicit about it, and then said, okay, so I'm terminating you as a patient, and then the and others knew about it in the clinic, and then the next day has a sexual relationship. So the sexual touching occurs the day after the relationship, professional relationship was ended. Winona State, in this hypothetical, knows all about it up until then. Does Winona State have no vicarious liability, arguably, for that conduct? Because the touching took place after and off campus?
I'm sorry. There's two concepts going on. In terms of the medical negligence claim, if as soon as the relationship between a therapist and patient terminates, there can be no vicarious responsibility from that point forward for the university, because the university in a negligence setting is only responsible for the acts committed within the course and scope of employment. And here that's her being a therapist. So to the extent all of the conduct that predated, that was taking place during the therapy sessions, the conversations, the gift giving, people knowing about it, if that all happened, they may argue that's a departure from the therapist's standard of care that creates an actionable claim of malpractice against Kirby. And because that's her role at the university can potentially be vicariously responsible through respondeat superior for that in a med mal claim. We argued, even if you assume that's true, it's time barred under the applicable statute of limitations. And the judge dismissed it on statute of limitations grounds. So the negligence claim is out on that basis for anything the university can be liable for. And they have not challenged that decision on this appeal. Just like the other negligent conduct they've alleged is direct tort liability through the negligent supervision, hiring, retention, and training at counts 5 and 6. The judge dismissed those claims for various reasons. That's not challenged on this appeal. So what remains then is the intentional conduct. Even if we have grooming to prove a battery claim, you need something more. You need the physical touching. And the complaint alleges that the sexual relationship started on July 7th of 2012. She was no longer a student at the university. She graduated on May 4th. The therapy relationship, whether it's at the university or whether it's at her private clinic, it doesn't matter, because all of it ended, according to the second amended complaint, on May 21st of 2012. And the dispositive point is that the complaint does not allege that any of the physical sexual activity that's required of the intentional battery claim took place at Winona State. And if you look at what they've represented to the court in the reply brief at page 10, a statement is made that, and I quote, sex did indeed happen later and off-site, end quote. And then at the trial court level, in their brief opposing our motion to dismiss, it's document 34 of the docket. At page 7 of that brief, I quote, they say, quote, the physical contact between Kirby and Doe occurred at a different location, end quote. That was never an issue. It's never been an issue. This case went through written discovery because it went for a year before it was filed on the right before they had to do so with that year period after service. And during that year period, there was written discovery change. We're on the second amended complaint. They asked to amend the complaint in response to our motion to dismiss. And in that amended pleading, they knew what we were saying with regard to the battery claim, the intentional claim, that it didn't occur on site. And they didn't fix the pleading, and they didn't fix it because under Rule 11, you can't allege something that's not true. She's a party to this conduct, and it has to occur on site. That's what tells us. That's the cookie salesman who showed up at a grocery store, physically assaulted the grocery store owner over a shelf spacing dispute, and there the time and place requirements were met because he was doing his job like he normally does at a customer's premises during office hours. The Marston case, and it was a couple of different patients, and the sexual contact in those cases took place at the clinic either during the therapy sessions or right after them. And on those facts, the time and space requirement to hold the employer vicariously responsible for that intentional conduct was met. And then the third case from the Supreme Court that talks about this issue is the Fahrendorf decision. And that was a minor who was a resident of a group home. And one night, the adult counselor, employee of that group home, had sexual contact with this individual on a couple of different occasions. And the court said, because the contact occurred at the facility during this counselor's shift, that meets the time and place requirements necessary to hold the employer vicariously responsible. And the other case that signifies this point is the federal case, the Rao decision that's in our brief. And that's the vicarious claim against the city of Minneapolis seeking to hold it responsible for the intentional physical assault of its police officer. And in that case, what happened was the police officer had ended his shift an hour before the assault. The assault took place at a car wash in Brooklyn Center. He doesn't have jurisdiction as a police officer in Brooklyn Center. And the court said, when you are doing this after you're off your shift at work, and it's outside of your jurisdiction, the employer cannot be vicariously responsible for your intentional physical assault because it happened outside the work-related limits of time and space. And that's exactly what we have here. It's not alleged in the complaint. They have admitted it at the trial court level and in their briefing here that you can talk about all of the grooming you want, but if it stops short of physical contact, you cannot state a claim as a matter of law for sexual battery. And so count the vicarious liability for that count is out as a matter of law for that reason. And the trial court was absolutely correct in dismissing that claim. And then everything else falls into the negligence context. And none of that has been appealed. And I know there's a little bit of confusion about count three and count four. I believe count three is just a regular negligence claim against defendant Kirby. And if they're basing that negligence claim on the sexual conduct that occurred, the university is not responsible for that because she's doing that off-site on her own time. It has nothing to do with the therapy. The therapy had already, that relationship had already ended. So what she does on her own time is not the university's responsibility when you're talking about a general negligence claim. It's different with the medical negligence, but not the general negligence at count three. And then the negligence per se for the criminal sexual conduct, again, the liability creating event at count three, or at count four, requires touching. That didn't happen at the university, and so it cannot be vicariously responsible under the Lange line of cases. And so for those reasons, when you break it down and actually look at the conduct and apply the facts as alleged or not alleged in the complaint and the admissions to the actual elements of the tort, and here the only issue is battery because all of that negligence stuff was not appealed. The direct claims of negligence and the med mal claim, that's not part of this appeal. So that leaves count two, the battery claim, and the vicarious responsibility for it. And the lack of touching at the university is absolutely dispositive. And for that reason...
Can you answer, and you just said, I think, like the claim three, the negligence claim, wasn't appealed. I was a little confused by it because it seemed like the district court order, if I recall correctly, just basically addressed claims one and claims two as they relate to claim seven. What do we mean that claim three wasn't appealed? It didn't really seem to be specifically addressed.
It was not addressed. And there was a different lawyer, Dan Singel, from Mr. Klug's office that argued at the trial court level. And this count three and count four were never an issue. We never moved. It's not pled against the university as we see it. It wasn't opposed on the basis that, hey, what about count three and count four? It just wasn't before the district court because it was my understanding when we were arguing it, everybody was agreeing that the vicarious responsibility for the university either rests in medical negligence or the intentional tort of battery that's termed sexual abuse at count two. But even if you take it a step further and go, okay, how is the negligence claim at count three different from count one for medical negligence? Well, it's negligence of Kirby not acting as a therapist, because if she's acting as a therapist, that's medical negligence. And if you don't have medical negligence, then she's not acting in a way that the university employs her to act. And so there can be no vicarious responsibility. It's no different than if I take my kid to swimming practice later today and get in a car crash and hurt somebody. My employer's not responsible for what I do on my own time. And so that's the difference. If there aren't any other questions, I don't have anything else to say. I thank you for your time, and we would respectfully request on behalf of the university that you affirm the trial court's dismissal. Thank you.
Mr. Duke, you'll have the last word. We need to set up the timer. First thing we're going to want you to respond to is just to clarify what is appealed as far as what this court addresses.
We are asking you to reverse Judge Opat's dismissal of count seven, and that necessarily encompasses counts two, three, and four. So I guess in easiest terms, it would be count seven, but then two, three, and four are brought along with that. I think what the district court was getting at was when you dismiss count seven, counts three and four necessarily go away if there's no vicarious liability, even though he didn't directly address those claims. But what we are asking for is a reversal of the district court's determination that Winona State cannot be vicariously liable for anything because the elements of vicarious liability are not satisfied. Now, in responding to Mr. Hintz's argument, he is inviting you to make exactly the same error as the district court. What Mr. Hintz is saying is that we know exactly what grooming does and does not encompass. He says we can know that. And the reason we can know that is because of sexual contact that's alleged in the complaint to have occurred in July of 2012. Again, there's the confusion that because we admit sex occurred after Ms. Doe left Winona State. Again, that's not disputed, but sexual contact is different than sexual abuse. And again, Mr. Hintz said,
Mr. Hintz's argument that when that issue was answered in the certified question, our Supreme Court said sexual abuse has to be, at least the intentional part has to be involve contact. I mean, how would you ask us to get around the Supreme Court's decision in that case?
We concede that sexual abuse needs to involve some element of contact. What Mr. Hintz is saying, and I can tell, this is where the confusion is coming in. Sexual contact, we allege in the complaint, occurred after July. But sexual contact is used in the complaint because it has a specific meaning under criminal law, and part of Ms. Doe's claims reference the criminal law, her claim of negligence per se. So where the confusion is coming in, and this is what Winona State is arguing, is that because we use the word sexual contact as of July 2012, no sexual contact. Okay, the district court made an inference in favor of Winona State, and they're asking you to do it again. They want you to infer that because we use the word sexual contact as of July 2012, that means that no contact of a sexual nature could have occurred before that. But what we're emphasizing is that sexual contact has a very specific meaning under Minnesota criminal law. What it means is the touching of specific areas of the body. Sexual contact is defined in Minnesota Statute 609.341. And what that means is touching of the breasts, groin, or buttocks. What we've taken great pains to emphasize is that there can be much physical contact that is sexual abuse that is not sexual conduct under criminal law. So if you recall the definitions that I gave, or the examples that I gave you before.
I want to make sure. So I mean, I understand there's a difference between, rape and touching. But my question is, do you agree with Mr. Hintz that sexual assault as defined by our Supreme Court must involves some physical contact.
Sexual abuse, Kolar, yes, it is a battery, which involves...
So I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying then that simply that your position is that grooming naturally assumes that there was contact sometime when the counselor and your client were, you know, in the therapy sessions at Winona State?
Yes. What we are arguing is that the term grooming can certainly include offensive contact of a sexual nature that is also not sexual contact as defined in Minnesota's criminal statutes. The difference is sexual contact is a reference.
You're muted, Judge Connolly.
I know you cited that commitment case that Judge Werke was on the road and that I was in the panel, but I'm sure you're shocked that I don't actually remember it that well. But, you know, I assume in that case is, you know, we're dealing with, you know, sexual predators. And SBP my concern is, I mean, I think I know when someone says that you're grooming this child, I think I get an idea of what that means. But I guess I'm not sure that I know for sure that it means that there's been some contact between the offender and the individual. So what case or what definition or what statute would I look at to know that, you know what, grooming, we applied grooming always means touching, therefore we're fine with, you know, what happened in the therapy session. What would I look at?
I see my time's expired, Your Honor. May I respond?
Yes, answer the question, please.
Judge, there is not a case that says grooming always means touching, but it definitely can be, and at the motion to dismiss stage, that is sufficient. The cases you would look at are Marston, State versus Leong, civil commitment of Reed, civil commitment of Alverson. All of these cases describe, quote, grooming or grooming behavior that involves unconsented to physical touching. And so just in closing, please don't make the error of the district court of confusing sexual contact and sexual abuse. That was the error below. We ask that you please not repeat it here. And we ask that you please reverse the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties. The matters were well briefed and well argued today. They are under advisement and a decision will be issued in the 90-day time period. You can go ahead and leave the conference now.
Thank you.
Thank you.